I have a question to start it off with, and it's a raise your hand question, or if you can't raise your hand, you can't raise it. How many of you have a favorite blog that you subscribe to that comes in every day? Raise your hand if you do. Wow, not that many. Now, I'm sure Mr. Witt, he didn't raise his hand. He probably has some. I have a few. In the business world, I have a particular blog. It's called HubSpot Marketing. And they're experts on digital marketing and everything associated with it. Things I don't know much about, and I'm trying to learn about them. And so I get every day, I get a blog sent in. And why would you have a blog sent in every day? By the way, the church has blogs. You can subscribe to the church blogs, right? Probably some of you do. Why would you do that? Well, the only reason you care about a blog is it has something it says, some content that's relevant to you. It's got great content. It means something to you. Maybe it inspires you or motivates you. On the business front, when I get HubSpot marketing blogs in, I don't every day find the topic to be relevant, but many days I do, and it helps me. It helps me in my world of business, in an area that I don't have a whole lot of knowledge on, but I need to come up to speed. It motivates me to improve what I do. Now, one of the blogs I do get every day, I may have mentioned it in the past, is one called All Pro Dad. Now, how many of you dads, raise your hand, how many of you dads would love to be called an All Pro Dad? All Pro Dad. All Pro Dad was founded by a gentleman named Mark Merrill, and his chief spokesman that founded it with him is a man named Tony Dungy. Tony Dungy is probably a name many of you recognize. Very famous football coach who really, if you read his story, and we've read books for clubs, for church about that Tony Dungy has written, a guy who won a Super Bowl as a head coach, first African-American to ever do that. We know him in this area because he played at the University of Minnesota and all that. But if you read about him and you hear what he says, what he was most concerned about when he coached was mentoring young men, many of whom came from the ghetto. They came from mean streets. They came from very broken families, many without father figures around. And he wanted them to become responsible husbands and fathers. And he carries that on to this day. Every day, All Pro Dad sends in five or six things about being a better dad, about being a better husband. And they're really good. They just remind me of some very simple things. They're not too preachy. They don't get into heavy theological things. They're things you would say to me if you were to advise me. And they just remind me. I got one in a couple months ago. And it was entitled, Six Short Sentences That Mean the World. Six Short Sentences That Mean the World. I'll propose to you today that these six short sentences can change the world of those around you. If you say them, and if you mean them, and if you live them out with action, if you back them up. Six short sentences that mean the world, I would call them six short sentences that can change the world. They can change the world of your children, first and foremost, if you're a father or a mother. And when I say father or mother, I'm not just referring to the times like I live in, where my kids live with me or with Colleen. I'm talking about all of you whose kids are grown. Some of you, they're long since grown. They need to hear these six short sentences from you. In whatever way it is, you say it. You may not say it exactly like you're going to hear it today, but in whatever way you say it, they can change the world of your grandchildren. I've watched my parents and my parents-in-law say these things. They said them to me from the time I was a kid. Changed my life. They say them today to me, to their other to children, to their grandchildren. They say them in their way. Sometimes they say these sentences verbatim. Sometimes not, but they say them. And they back everything they say with action, with deeds. Six short sentences that can change the world of your children, your grandchildren. They can change the world of your extended family if you just say them and you live them. They can change the world of your friends that you have. They can change the world of your fellow church members, people sitting in this room, if you really mean them when you say it, if you back it up with action. They can change the world of anyone we come across with in our life, from any walk of life. They will do things like we heard about in the sermonette. They will impart courage. They will build people up. They will make people feel like they walk through this life and they're not all alone. That there's always someone there. Always someone there with them, backing them up in the best of times and the worst of times. Here's the irony. God does the same thing to you. He says the same things. We're going to read them right from his word. Maybe in a little different words, but you'll see. God does the same thing to all of us in this room. He says these things, and he backs them up. Big time. Where would we be if God didn't say these things to us, and then we knew and had complete faith that he would back them up? You see, when we do these things, we're going to hear six short sentences today. That's what you're going to hear. When we say them and when we do them, we're just imitating God at the end of the day. At the end of the day. I implore you today. I beg you. Write these six short sentences down. Write the scriptures down. I didn't write them. I can't give you these inspirations. God can. Write them down. I don't care how old you are or how young you are. If you're not married yet and you don't have kids, write them down so that you learn to use these words to change the lives of others. Six short sentences that will change the world of those in your lives. Number one, the first sentence, I'm here for you. I'm here for you. You ever said that to anyone? Turn to Isaiah 41, please. While you're turning there to Isaiah 41, ask yourself, have I ever said this to my child? Have I ever said this to my friend? Have I ever said this to my parents? Have I ever said this to someone in here? Or is it something I live? Do the people around me know that this is who I am? I'm here for you. Now, listen to this verse. This is one of the greatest, most inspiring scriptures ever written about God saying, I'm here for you. Isaiah 41 and verse 13. Isaiah 41 and verse 13. God says to you and to me, for I, the Lord your God, will hold your right hand, saying to you, fear not, I will help you. God says, I'm so here for you that I'm not just telling you that. He says, I'm holding your right hand. You ever fall down and have someone grab your right hand or your hand and pull you up? One of the things I'm most proud of when I watch my girls play sports is when one of the teams or players on the other team that they're competing against falls, and either my daughter or one of their teammates reaches their hand out in the midst of the competition and pulls them up. God says, I hold your right hand. What he's saying by that is he's saying, I'm right here with you. Imagine me holding your hand. You can't imagine what it meant to me recently to be able to walk around Washington, D.C. with my wife and two daughters, and I could hold my daughter's hand, and they at a minimum at least acted like I didn't embarrass them. Maybe I did. Doesn't it feel wonderful when you hold somebody's hand, someone you love? Because it says, we're together. We're in this thing together. I'm here. That meant more to me to hold my little Ella's hand, and she's not so little anymore, when I walked around D.C. Nothing means more to me as a dad than when my daughter walks up to me, and I don't ask her, she puts her arm around me. Nothing! Because it says to me, we're together. I'm here for you. You're here for me. I remember when one of my daughters, many years ago, came to Colleen and me, and she came to Colleen first, with an issue, with something that she had done. She was upset at herself. She didn't have to tell us. Didn't have to tell us, this particular daughter. She was not happy with herself. She felt what she did was wrong. There was a bit of feeling ashamed, I suppose. She came to Colleen, and then Colleen came to me and said, this daughter of ours is going to talk to you. So she came and she told me what had happened. And there were tears. What do you think I did as a father? Did I need to correct her? No. She already knew what she'd done is wrong. I was so pleased. I was so happy that she was willing to come to me and say that. Because what I was able to say is that anytime you go through something, even if it's something you're not happy about or it's difficult or it's something even that you feel you did wrong or you're ashamed of, know that your mother and that I are here for you. We want to help you through it. We're here. We're not going to judge you. If you know and your conscience tells you, we're here for you. I felt feelings of love and empathy and a desire to help her. That's how God is. So he is with you. Because you fall and you need that right hand pulling you back up. I fall, I need that right hand pulling you back up, pulling me back up, excuse me. I'm here for you. Say those words. Who needs to hear that statement from you? We know our kids need to hear it. We know our grandkids need to hear it. Who else? Who needs to hear that from you? Who needs to see that backed up with action in your life? I'm here for you. Second sentence that will change the world. Second sentence. I'm proud of you. You can turn to Matthew 3. I'm proud of you. Now, some will, you know, maybe even some of you might be tempted to say, well, you know, the society we live in today, it's all just boost the kids up and just build them up, and it's that's all it is, and that's all they ever get. That's a cop-out if you say that. There is nothing more important than appropriately telling a child when they do right, when they work hard, even if they fail, but they worked. I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you for what you did or for what you tried to do. I'm proud of the way you thought. I'm proud of the way you reasoned through that trial or that challenge or that problem. I'm proud of you. We have plenty of opportunities and need at times to correct children, to course correct them. You don't need me to tell you that. That's the easy part of what we know we need to do, but we need to be able to tell them, I'm proud of you. Those of you with really gray heads that have really grown up kids and you have grandkids, do you tell your kids, I'm proud of you? Do you still do it? Do they hear those words? I heard those words growing up. And believe me, I had a lot of times when I got a lot of serious course correction in my life. But I heard those words when it was appropriate. It changed my life. The two gray-headed people in my family sitting in here still say those words to their children and their grandchildren, and probably to many of you, I suppose. I don't know. In Matthew chapter 3, one of the greatest statements ever made in the Bible from God to another person, and in this case to God in the flesh, to Jesus Christ. Right after he's baptized, when he came up, what was it that God said to him? Matthew 3:17, and suddenly a voice from heaven saying, this is the Father speaking to Jesus Christ, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." What do you want God to say to you when you come to the judgment seat? What would be the first words you would want to hear from God? This is what I would want to hear. I just hope and pray I can hear these words. A lot of times I feel like, that's not the words I'm going to hear today. Sorry. But that's what I want to hear. I'm not comparing myself to Christ. In that sense, he was perfect. Boy, did he deserve these words. But boy, would I love to hear these words. "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." When you tell a child, "I'm proud of you," you're saying to them, "I'm well pleased." Do you tell your children that? Do you tell your grandchildren? Do you tell your friends when they do something awesome? Or do you tell them you're just pleased to have them in your life? How about your fellow church members? It's just telling them you're well pleased and simply pleased to have a relationship with them. Parents can say that to children. Children, how about to your parents? When you get to be 53 years old and you have a set of parents and a set of parents-in-law like I do, I can tell them I'm well pleased. I'm really thankful. I'm really humbled. And I can tell my kids that we stand here today. We're sitting here today in this church because of your grandparents, my parents, the Wades, my parents-in-law. You know why? Because though all the credit goes to God, he called them. He called them first. He pulled our family out of this world. And where would we be if they didn't heed that calling and stay faithful to it? Where would we be? If you have a parent that has impacted you, whether it be that way. Some of you don't have parents that impacted you that way. But if you have parents that impacted you and they're still faithful, or grandparents, tell them you're proud of them and you're thankful. Parents aren't perfect. We all know that. You don't need to turn there, but I just want to let you know that it's so important to say, "I'm proud of you." Even the Apostle Paul got this. You don't need to turn there, but you can write it down. 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 4. Paul says to a Corinthian church, a church in Corinth that he had strongly corrected, but he had seen them heed his correction. Here's what he said. "Great is my boldness of speech toward you. Great is my boldness of speech toward you. Great is my boasting on your behalf." He says, guess what, Corinthian church? I'm proud of you. I'll even brag you up. I'll boast on your behalf. I am filled with comfort. I am exceedingly joyful in all our tribulation. I'm proud of you. Write it down. Say it. Mean it. Live it. Who in your life needs to hear that right now? We all go through a lot, and sometimes you just need to know that someone really important to you is proud of you. Sentence number three. Sentence number three. I believe in you. I believe in you. Now, these start They all relate, but they're a little different. The differences can be a little subtle, but they're real. I believe in you. You can turn to John chapter 15. I believe in you. Telling someone you believe in them means that you have confidence they'll succeed. Have you ever had someone tell you after you really messed up and you couldn't feel worse, and somehow, some way, shape, or form, they get this sentence across to you: I believe in you. Or maybe they say, I still really believe in you. It means everything, especially when you really messed up or you're going through a tough time. When someone says, I believe in you. I see your strengths. I see your challenges. More importantly, I see your heart. John 15 and verse 16. This is Jesus Christ speaking. I believe this is his way of telling you and me that he believes in us. Write this scripture down. Read this to your kids. Read it to yourself. These are the most powerful words ever written that strengthen us. Jesus said, you did not choose me. Not one of us in here would ever choose Jesus Christ. But look what he says. But I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit. Do you think Jesus Christ would choose you or me and then appoint you? I got something for you to do. He's appointed you and me to bear fruit, to grow in our lives. Do you think he would do that if he didn't believe in us? If he didn't think we could get there? Never. Because that would be disingenuous on his part. And he's not disingenuous. He said, I've chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should remain. I believe you not only can do it, but you're going to keep bearing fruit. I don't believe you're going to do it for a while. I have confidence in you. That's what Jesus Christ says to us. Do we really believe that? Do we believe he has confidence in us? Do we have that kind of confidence then in ourselves because he chose us and appointed us to bear fruit? He says, why? Because I know here, he says, that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give you. Sometimes all people have to know is that we believe in him. We see good. We see strengths. We see talents. We see phenomenal attitudes. I was teasing Gary Peterson because I could tease him, and Dave Witt, two guys I love to tease, about a statement that I have about negativity and how bad negativity is. And I told that to Gary Peterson, knowing that he's the kind of guy who will come up here and give a sermonette on courage. That's positive. We need to encourage one another because God believes in that, and he gives us courage. He appointed us. Sometimes that's all people need to know for their talents and their strengths to blossom. How many of you have read the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People? It's an old book now. Some of you have. Great book. There's a story in here that Stephen Covey tells about one of his sons, one of his younger sons back in the day. And him and his wife, Sandra, were having trouble because this son didn't measure up to the older siblings. They were very successful. So I'll read a little bit about this, but it teaches us something about believing in someone. And sometimes that's all someone needs to know. It's very easy to criticize, right? To straighten someone out, to pick apart their weaknesses, to remember the bad things they did. But that's not what this is about. It's about focusing on the good things. He says a few years ago, my wife Sandra and I were struggling with this kind of concern. One of our sons was having a very difficult time in school. Now remember, Covey was and is a very intelligent, well-studied psychologist. Okay, so this is a guy who spent his life studying into this kind of stuff. He was a master at psychology, or so he thought. He was doing poorly academically. He didn't even know how to follow the instructions on the tests, let alone do well on them. Socially, he was immature, often embarrassing those closest to him. Athletically, he was small, skinny, and uncoordinated. Swinging his baseball bat, for example, almost before the ball was even pitched, others would laugh at him. Sandra and I were consumed with a desire to help him. What parent wouldn't be? All of us want to help our kids, especially when they're struggling. And of course we try to help them. He goes on, he says, we felt that if success, quote unquote, were important in any area of life, it was supremely important in our role as parents. See, they wanted to help get him to be successful. You see, we get a lot of social capital sometimes as parents out of our kids' success, right? Makes you feel good as a parent when your kid succeeds. But sometimes that motive can be wrong. It can go too far. And that's what Covey and his wife learned. He says, so we worked on our attitudes and our behavior toward him, and we tried to work on his. We attempted to psych him up using positive mental attitude techniques. Come on, son, you can do it. We know you can. Put your hands a little higher on the bat and keep your eye on the ball. Sorry, M&L, if I do that. Don't swing till it gets close to you. And if he did a little better, we would go to great lengths to reinforce him. That's good, son. Keep it up. See, they wanted to change him. He had to fit their social concerns. He had to continue to make them feel good, just like the older kids did. They got social capital off of their kids. That's what they wanted. And so all of their propping of them up was for themselves, not for the kid. He goes on to say, he says, when others laughed, we reprimanded them. Leave him alone. Get off his back. He's just learning. And our son would cry and insist that he'd never be any good and that he didn't like baseball anyway. Nothing we did seemed to help. And we were really worried. We couldn't see the effect this was having on his self-esteem. Uh-oh. Now things are getting bad. The kid's not only not succeeding, but the self-esteem is going down the drain. What do? You keep propping him up and it's not working. They're not able to change. They're not able to meet your mold to be who you want them to be. And suddenly, they not only feel like you don't believe in them, but they don't believe in themselves. He says, we tried to be encouraging and helpful and positive, but after repeated failure, we finally drew back and tried to look at the situation on a different level. So that's what they did. They stepped back and they evaluated themselves. And they realized that they weren't appreciating the kid just for who he was, what he was, what his talents were. They were trying to manipulate him into what they wanted him to be. Not that we don't try to move our kids in the right direction and help them and guide them. I'm not talking about that. But when it goes to the point that it fits our social concerns, it changes. So they switched. They changed. Here's what happened. Through deep thought and the exercise of faith and prayer, we began to see our son in terms of his own uniqueness. We saw within him layers and layers of potential. I believe in you. I see potential in you. We saw layers and layers of potential that would be realized at his pace and his speed. We decided to relax and get out of his way and let his own personality emerge. We saw our natural role as being to affirm, enjoy, and value him. Enjoying that person tells them you believe in them. I think we see a lot of that in our church congregation. We enjoy each other. What kind of tells each other that we believe in each other? There's a closeness. We just enjoy being together. Tells us we believe in why we're here and what we're doing. He goes on, he says, we also conscientiously worked on our own motives and cultivated internal sources of security so that our own feelings of worth were not dependent on our child's acceptable behavior. What were the results? As we loosened up our old perception of our son and developed value-based motives, new feelings began to emerge. We found ourselves enjoying him instead of comparing or judging him. As the weeks and months passed, he began to feel a quiet confidence and affirmed himself. Didn't need mom and dad to manipulate him all the time. He started to become affirmed because they let him grow at his pace. They were there for him. They believed in him. But they let him grow at his pace. He became outstanding as measured by standard social criteria, academically, socially, and athletically, at a rapid clip far beyond the so-called natural developmental process. As the years passed, he was elected to several student body leadership positions, developed into an all-state athlete, and started bringing home straight-A report cards. This is a guy who couldn't even take tests. He developed an engaging and guileless personality that has enabled him to relate in non-threatening ways to all kinds of people. Sometimes I believe in you. It's just seeing that potential in someone else, helping them to nurture it, and then just enjoying watching them grow at their pace. I believe in you. Who needs to hear that from you? Who needs to experience that in your life? Sentence number 4. I want the best for you. I want the best for you. You can turn to Jeremiah 29, Jeremiah chapter 29. Now, these things seem obvious, right? Well, yeah, we want the best for our kids and our grandkids and people here and our friends and our family, and we want the best. But do people really experience that with you? I want the best for you. The scripture we're going to read here, I don't think God could say it in any plainer terms, that he wants the best for you. He wants the best for me. One great thing about God and his word is he just tells us. He says it. This is a great scripture to print off and put it on your fridge or put it on your wall, just like he might have the Ten Commandments hung somewhere. These are great scriptures for you and your kids and your grandkids and others that come in to read. Jeremiah 29 and verse 11, for I know the thoughts that I think toward you. What does God think towards you and me? It says, I know the thoughts that I think towards you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope. Think of all the mess ups you have had in your life, all the mess ups you have. And yet God still says, I think good thoughts of you. I want the best for you. I think thoughts of peace and not of evil. And I want to give you a future and a hope. I want the best for you. That's what God tells us. That's something to wake up to every day, knowing that God wants the best for us. He wants to give us a future and a hope. We know that. But do we imitate him? Do people hear that from us? And all the words that we say, does it come out? Is it a part of who we are? You know, there's some interesting statistics from the National Health Council about chronic disease. Did you know that according to their statistics, and that chronic disease is a disease lasting 3 months or longer, that about 40 million Americans are limited in their usual activities due to one or more chronic health conditions? You see, we all have health conditions, whether they're physical, maybe there's some mental health conditions, some emotional health conditions. We all face the challenge of being human, no surprise. Listen to some of these stats about chronic diseases. Generally, incurable and ongoing, chronic diseases affect approximately 133 million Americans. Chronic diseases, representing more than 40% of the total population of this country. By 2020, that number is projected to grow at an estimated 157 million, and 81 million having multiple conditions. About half of all adults have a chronic condition, and approximately 8% of children ages 5 to 17 were reported by their parents to have limited activities due to at least one chronic disease. More and more people are living with not just one chronic illness, such as diabetes, heart disease, or depression, but with two or more conditions. You see, there are people in this audience who have diabetes, heart disease, perhaps depression. Some of you have more than one condition. Some of you have other conditions to go along with this. Life's not easy. A lot of times we go through great emotional distress, challenge in our life. We all do. We all face it. Is there anything more important than these sentences that we're reading? That they're said, that someone says as we go through things, I want the best for you. I want the best for you, and I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you achieve the best you can. I may not be able to solve all your problems for you, but I'm going to be here, and I want the best for you. When's the last time someone heard that from you in some way, shape, or form? Or maybe the question is better, are enough people hearing that from you and from me? In one way, shape, or form. Again, it doesn't have to be those exact words. But they know that you want the best for them, no matter what they're going through, good, bad, or ugly. So important. Number five, the fifth sentence. I will stand with you. I will stand with you. I'm here standing with you. Let's turn to Psalm 91. Psalm 91. I love this scripture. Because when I think of someone standing with me, I think of being in battle. Where more would you want someone standing side by side with you than in battle? So think of God in this way when you battle through life and the trials and the challenges. Psalm 91 and verse 7. This is what he says to us. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near to you. We can be in the midst of battle, the battle of life, and 1,000 can fall around us. 10,000 can fall just on our right-hand side. I'm the next one to go, aren't I? God says, no. When I'm with you, it ain't going to happen, and it will not come near to you. Why is that? Why can God say that? It's because he stands right at our side. When we see troubles and problems around us, we see God standing there with us. He's real. He's reachable. He's touchable. He props us up. Ironically, I had a second scripture for which you don't need to turn to because you should have in the sermonette, but I'm going to reread it. In Joshua chapter 1 and verse 5, Mr. Peterson, we can be happy because the messages have looped together. In verse 5, it says, no man shall be able to stand before you. See, God says, I'll stand for you. I'll stand with you. But he says, don't worry. No man will be able to stand in front of you and cause you harm. He says, no one will stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I shall be with you. That's why we have courage. That's why we know we can get through anything, because God stands with us. He says, I will not leave you or forsake you. No matter how heated the battle in our lives, no matter how heated the trial, he says, I am there always. I will never, ever leave you. I feel that way about my parents. As long as they're taking breath, I believe they will never leave me or forsake me. Do your kids feel that way about you? Even when they're grown, I'm 53 years old, and I still feel that way. Do your kids feel that way? Moses continued to encourage. He says in verse 6, be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. You see, we can be of good courage because when God stands with us, he delivers. He says, if I'm going to deliver for you, it's going to happen. I'm going to divide the land. You're going to get it. God delivers. You know, we've all had to go through experiences at times with our kids. Probably the most unnerving experience we ever had is one you would know about and wouldn't be surprised, was when our youngest daughter, Ella, had back surgery 2 years ago, January 8th, 2015. And even though there are far worse conditions that young people go through, far worse, it was still a serious surgery where she had a very severe curvature in her spine and two rods were going to be placed in there. It was very unnerving, and you knew about this. We asked for your prayers and you prayed. And it was unnerving for not only Colleen and myself, but for her sister and for her grandparents and all of you. We all feel that, don't we, when someone goes through a surgery or a difficulty. Fortunately, she came through that with flying colors, thanks to God, thanks to prayers. Doesn't mean it was all easy. But every year, Elle and I made a decision to go back on that day, January 8th. Happened to fall on a Sunday this year, but if it fell on a work day, I'd take the afternoon off, and we would go back to Children's Hospital. We've done it for 2 years since her surgery. And why do we do that? Well, it's because we never want to forget what not only she went through, but what we went through as a family. And the bigger thing is, and Ella and I will talk about this when we walk the halls of Children's Hospital and we see children there and we see what they're going through. We don't want to forget what they're going through, and we don't want to forget that God was there. He stood in the midst of our family. Sometimes we don't always get what we want from God, but God stands with us. Do we imitate God? Do people know that we stand with them throughout all the circumstances of life? Now, I know you do that. I do that too. Colleen does that. But the question is do enough people really know that? Do they experience that from us? I will stand with you in all circumstances. Parents, older parents, grandparents, I hope your kids and your grandkids experience what we do in my household from my parents and my in-laws. I hope your kids and grandkids experience that. They really need to. My mom and dad are not spring chickens anymore, and I still feel like they will stand with me and my wife and my children every bit as much as when I was the little kid. Every day, I will stand with you. The last sentence, the sixth sentence, is the one we all know. I hope and pray we all say this daily to those whom we love, because the last three are those, that last sentence is those three famous words, I love you. You can turn to John chapter 13. Oh, come on, Corey. That's so obvious. I've told you the story about when Colleen and I would go visit her late grandfather on her father's side. A nice but feisty old Norwegian. Oh, did he love his granddaughter. Whew! I've told you, he just thought I was the greatest guy ever for one reason only, because he had never heard a complaint about me mistreating his granddaughter. If he had, that feisty old Norwegian probably would have belted me. And oh, did he love his granddaughter. And every time she would leave, I'd shake his hand, man to man. He wasn't into hugging guys. He was a feisty old Norwegian, but he'd get a nice hug from his granddaughter. Oh, did he like his hugs from his granddaughter? And she'd say, "Grandpa, I love you." And I've told you the story. He'd say, "I know." Couldn't say it. Now, Colleen knew he loved her, but I don't think Colleen's dad ever heard that. I never asked him, but I bet you money he never did. Generational in a way, he'd grown up in a really tough environment. He wasn't called by God. I'm not being down on him, believe me. We loved him and we think fondly of him. But how important are these words? That those we love, our children, our spouses, hear it every day, and if not every day, that they do hear it on a somewhat regular basis. Some families are more like that. Some people are more like that. I hear some of you say that here to me and all that. Some people, that's a little, you know, too much, crossing a line. Okay, I know you love me, but, you know, settle down. You know, I love you, man. Well, Jesus said it in John 13, one of the greatest two verses ever written. Could you have something more inspiring than this? "A new commandment I give to you," verse 34, "that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another." Well, is that sappy? That Jesus says, "I have loved you"? Well, we know he did. We know he does, based on what he's done. He says, "Just now go out and do it." Here he says it. I have loved you. But he says, now go do something with that. Go imitate what I am, what I do. Verse 35, "By this will all know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another." Who needs to hear from you in the words, "I love you"? It's not sappy. It's not unimportant, as we know. Interesting story here I'll read as we begin to wind down. And yes, Jonathan, that means I am beginning to wind down. Sorry, Gabrielle, it's not going to go an hour and a half. It's from a LinkedIn story. I found it posted on LinkedIn, came on my storyline. It's from a guy named Hardesh Kumar Sood. Never heard of him until I read this story. Here's the title of the story. It's a true story. He tells, recounts a story in his life, and he entitles it, "The Importance of Saying in Time, I Love You," sharing a story. Saying it in time, before it's too late. "After 21 years of marriage, my wife wanted me to take another woman out to dinner and a movie." First read that sentence, I was like, where's this thing going? "She said, I love you, but I know this other woman loves you and would love to spend time with you. The other woman that my wife wanted me to visit was my mother, who has been a widow for 19 years. But the demands of my work and my three children had made it possible to visit her only occasionally. That night I called to invite her to go out for dinner and a movie." "What's wrong? Are you well?" she asked. I think my mom would ask the same thing. "Mom, I just want to take you out for dinner and a movie. Everything okay?" "My mother is the type of woman who suspects that a late night call or a surprise invitation is a sign of bad news." "I thought that it would be pleasant to be with you," I responded, "just the two of us." She thought about it for a moment and then said, "I would like that very much." That Friday after work, as I drove over to pick her up, I was a bit nervous. When I arrived at her house, I noticed that she too seemed to be nervous about our date. She waited in the door with her coat on. You can see the older lady there waiting with her coat on. She had curled her hair and was wearing the dress that she had worn to celebrate her last wedding anniversary. She smiled from a face that was as radiant as an angel's. "I told my friends that I was going to go out with my son, and they were very impressed," she said as she got into the car. "They can't wait to hear about our meeting." "We went to a restaurant that, although not elegant, was very nice and cozy. It was I who used to have to read the menu when you were small," she said. "Then it's time that you relax and let me return the favor," I responded. I suppose her eyes were dimming. I like that statement. During the dinner, we had an agreeable conversation, nothing extraordinary, but catching up on recent events of each other's life. We talked so much that we missed the movie. As we arrived at her house later, she said, "I'll go out with you again, but only if you let me invite you." I agreed. So this time, Mom was going to invite Son. "How was your dinner date?" asked my wife when I got home. "Very nice, much more so than I could have imagined," I answered. A few days later, my mother died of a massive heart attack. Only a few days later. It happened so suddenly that I did not get to do anything for her. Sometime later, I received an envelope with a copy of a restaurant receipt from the same place Mother and I had dined. An attached note said, "I paid this bill in advance. I wasn't sure that I could be there, but nevertheless, I paid for two plates. One for you and the other for your wife. You will never know what that night meant for me. I love you, Son." You see, at that moment, he learned how important it is to express your love. Sounds kind of sappy, doesn't it? But to this audience, it's not. Do the people in your life know that you love them? I remember when my daughters were really small. I don't know if they'll remember this. They would ask, "How do we know that you love us?" So my mom or my wife and I would give our answers, and mine always was one that I think Colleen thought was a bit morbid, but she appreciated it. I'd always say that, "Well, you know that I love you, is that if anyone comes in here and tries to hurt you, they're going to have to come through me, even if they have to kill me." And the girls would be like, "Oh." Colleen would be like, "Hey, the girl, they're little girls." One time Ella was asked, "How do you know your dad loves you?" She said, "Because he'd die for me." That was maybe the best thing I ever heard in my life. That she knew that. That in all my morbidity when they were kids, she knew that. That I didn't tell her I love her every day only. But that if it really mattered, I would die. Who needs to know in our life more so than they do today how much we love them? I love you. Who needs to know that we would die for them, just like Jesus died for us? Doesn't have to be literal death. We don't usually go around telling people that. But that we'd sacrifice for them, we'd do anything for them. You see, six short sentences that changed the world. Six short sentences. Are they a part of your vocabulary? Are they a part of your life? Why did they change the world? Why did they change lives? "I'm here for you. I'm proud of you. I believe in you. I want the best for you. I will stand with you. I love you." Why do they change the world? Why do they change the lives of the people around us? It's because it sends one simple message. It tells them that they are not walking through this life alone. Nobody wants to walk through this life alone. They want to know that they've got people who care for them, that are there with them. They want to hear it. They want to experience it. Not just our children, not just our grandchildren. Everyone that we come in contact with, where we can say these sentences sincerely, they want to know this. They tell our children, our grandchildren, our families, our friends, our fellow church members, people we work with, people from all walks of lives that we encounter, that we not only care deeply about them, but that we'll back it, we'll back all the words with action, just like God does. Remember these six short sentences that change the world.